How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall? A Skill-Based Life was presented by Chris Swanson at Gutenberg College's Conference on Education, Mastery Not Factory, How We Learn What Matters, on February 21, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Chris Swanson is one of my colleagues at Gutenberg College. He has a PhD in physics. He's a polymath. He also teaches Jane Austen in English literature, amongst other literatures, at Gutenberg College. He and his wife, Cindy, homeschooled three of their kids. Two of them now attend Gutenberg. The title of his talk is How to Get to Carnegie Hall, A Skill-Based Life.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Welcome. For those of you who are understandably mystified as to why Carnegie Hall is in my title, I have the following very short story by way of explanation. An absent-minded maestro was racing up New York's 7th Avenue to a rehearsal when a stranger stopped him. "Pardon me," he said, "can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall?"
"Yes,"
answered the maestro breathlessly. "Practice, practice, practice." I like this story because it fits so well with what I'm going to talk about, namely that wisdom is a skill. Preliminary to my discussion of skills, I would like to set out for you a few of my assumptions. First, I am going to simply assume that the goal of education is wisdom, not career advancement. I realize that this may be a rather shocking and controversial assumption. However, to defend it would take us too far afield from my topic. If you think this is a cop-out, you're right. You might want to prepare yourself to get used to it. Nevertheless, for those that find it hard to accept such an un-American sentiment, I can offer at least this small olive branch. I am not trying to pit wisdom against career advancement and successful economic life. I am not suggesting that to be wise you must avoid seeking a career. In fact, I think it is wise to provide for yourself and your family economically. I am assuming, however, that there has been an undue emphasis placed upon career and job placement in our thinking about education. Second, I also assume that a large part of education has historically been wisdom and character development. Only recently, in the last 100 years or so, has the focus changed. Again, a defense of this assumption would not be too hard to produce, but it is outside of the scope of this talk. This is the part where you are starting to get used to the cop-out. Thirdly, I am going to assume that by wisdom we mean understanding and living in accordance with the truth. This is not the only way to define wisdom by any means. There are lots of other ways of defining it that amount to much the same thing. If you look up wisdom in a dictionary, you will find things like good judgment or a disposition to act in a manner which achieves the best possible outcome. However, I believe that what makes good judgment good and what makes an outcome best is when it lines up with what is true about the world, about ourselves, and about God. Maybe some examples would help. Suppose a young child sees a cute dog across the street and decides to make a dash for the dog without looking for cars. This is not a wise decision. Why? Because the child is either not aware of the reality of fast cars on the road or is ignoring that reality, or both. Perhaps the child's parents have given instruction, but it has not sunk in. The child is acting foolishly because there are significant truths about the world the child has not taken into consideration. Here's another example. We would think it unwise for a person to mistreat others for financial gain. Why? Because the person has not understood the relative importance of loving one's neighbor over and above financial gain. While it is true that financial gain can be beneficial, this person has neglected the truth about what life is about, what God created us for, and perhaps also the satisfaction to be obtained from such an act. In 1 Corinthians, Paul contrasts the wisdom of the world with the wisdom of God. The wisdom of the world is only apparent wisdom, since it seeks to act in accordance with what the Greeks perceived to be the truth. Those who were seen to be wise were debaters and scribes. But Paul is saying that the Greeks did not know the truth about Christ, their understanding of the truth was flawed, that what they took to be wisdom was not wisdom. Knowing the truth about Christ and following him, says Paul, is wisdom. This is the abbreviated Spark Notes version of these verses. If you want a fuller account, you can consult Ron, who has taught on this before. Hopefully, by this point, you are really used to the cop-out. My point only is that I think the idea of wisdom is in accordance with how the Bible is speaking about it. And lastly, I will assume throughout that we are speaking from a human perspective. Ultimately, God is the one who turns our hearts to him, who sanctifies us and gives us wisdom. Our adoption of his will and his commandments as our own is his work. It is a gift, and we cannot gain it without his grace. Nevertheless, there is a human aspect to gaining wisdom as well that we all recognize, and it is this aspect that I wish to speak about. So now that the preliminaries are out of the way, I would like to raise the question of how wisdom is gained. I propose that wise living is a skill, similar to other skills, and must be gained through a sort of apprenticeship rather than through the efficient transfer of information paradigm. I am convinced that what most of us see as good education today is efficient transfer of information. Students must know X, Y, and Z to be well educated. Thus, the task of the modern educator is to find the most efficient way to put that knowledge into the students' minds. But if wisdom is a skill, as I am arguing, and if fostering wisdom and character is the goal of education, then modern education is heading in the wrong direction. In order to make my case, I would like to begin by talking about skills in general, their nature, and how they are imparted. So, what are skills? Perhaps the best way to get into this topic is through some more examples. Consider the skill of handwriting. In first grade, writing letters was a difficult task. I recall that my lines never seemed to go in just the right places. My letters never looked as good as the teacher's. When I was starting out, I did not even know where to put the pencil down to start a letter. I had to learn where to start for every letter. As I practiced and compared my letters to the accepted letters, I improved. I got faster. I became more skilled. But at some point, I quit improving. I've never had the patience to really apply myself. I was more interested in getting the words down quickly than legibly. In short, I did not desire to improve. That handwriting is a skill became particularly apparent to me during my early years of teaching at Gutenberg. One student, Sarah Waringa, turned in a paper to me handwritten. I was awestruck. The complexity and beauty of the handwriting were truly amazing. It was a work of art. What was more astonishing was that she occasionally decided to change her handwriting and adopt a variation. That kind of blew me away. Obviously, Sarah had mastered the skill of handwriting. Another skill that I am familiar with and that I enjoy very much is playing soccer. Even though most of you are not soccer players or fans, I bring it up because it is illustrative of a number of aspects of skills. I have played since I was quite young. And as with any other sport, it takes a lot of practice to be able to play well. In the last 5 years, however, I have thought more about how to develop skill at soccer and the best approaches to achieve success. I have come to a few conclusions that in the past I sort of knew in an academic way, but as the pat answers we all give, but now I have come to a much deeper appreciation of them. They are, first, mastery. Fundamentals must become mastered and ingrained. Second, training. Practicing a lot is not sufficient. You must practice in the right ways. Third, desire to improve and self-evaluation. If you want to improve, you must become your own coach to correct mistakes. No amount of coaching will help an unwilling subject. These may seem like obvious aspects of learning soccer, and they are. But they are common to all skills, not just soccer. By looking at the simple example of soccer, in some detail, I hope we can better understand these common features of all skills. Number one, mastery of fundamentals. By fundamentals, I mean the act of stopping and controlling a ball and passing. Being able to do these things without thinking is one of the keys to playing well. The best players are not great because they are concentrating on ball control more than others. In fact, they seem to be concentrating less. Their muscles know what to do from long training, like learning letters. Ball control actions need to develop to the point where attention can be focused on something else. When I am practicing ball control, I am self-conscious about it, trying to improve. But in a game, I can focus my attention elsewhere because the skill has become ingrained. The fact that the skill is ingrained in me and does not require my focus is a feature of all skills. Number two, training. Simply making 1,000 passes does not necessarily make me a good passer if my technique is poor. Poor technique results in poor passing. In my early years, I developed some bad habits in my game. To retrain myself, I have had to self-consciously practice the better technique. To the extent that I have not thoroughly trained myself out of the bad habits, they come back. I tell myself over and over, "Don't do that," but I do it. If I have learned to do something poorly, that poor practice will become ingrained, just as a good technique becomes ingrained. I always unconsciously act in accordance with how I have been trained. The same is true with handwriting. If I don't carefully train my hand to write neatly, I will write poorly. In most cases, this sort of training occurs in an apprentice-style relationship. It is rare that an individual will just happen upon good technique and good results, good methods of practice. It is much better to find a good coach who has learned the best methods and best training. Under the tutelage of a good coach, players learn only good techniques. That way, they do not need retraining later. The other key feature of coaching is the constant correction. A coach can watch and see problems in my technique and correct them before it is too late. The more complex the skill, the longer the apprenticeship must last. I would like to make a brief side comment here about tradition. The expert or coach has become expert through tradition. A good coach is someone who has already mastered the skill in question. The coach was presumably an apprentice to a previous coach, and that coach apprenticed with some other predecessor, and so on. But where did the skill originate? My guess is that it is built up over time, honed and improved with each generation of practitioners. Those methods which worked were passed on, and those that did not were discarded. The body of knowledge embedded in the masters of the skill is tradition. Craftsmen such as tailors or farmers receive their skills from a prior generation through tradition. In the event that a tradition is lost due to a change in culture or technology, it is not easily regained. Personally, I think that technology and efficiency have led to a tragic loss in traditional skills. 3. Self-evaluation. Finding others to coach me, however, is not enough. I must be my own coach. During training, every time I stop the ball or make a pass, I am judging my performance. I am making adjustments to what I am doing, trying to get a good result. I cannot rely solely on someone else to tell me what to do, because ultimately I have to take responsibility to make the skill my own. No one can do it for me. The desire must be there. Those who really desire to excel tend to have success because they are constantly self-evaluating. The importance of the component of desire or will cannot be underestimated. No one can be forced to become skilled, whether the skill is handwriting, soccer, or some other more important skill. Like wisdom, each learner must decide to take on the training. As teachers or coaches, we can give incentives, both carrots and sticks. We can model the skill. We can provide powerful arguments for the benefits of developing the skill. But we cannot force someone to take on the task because we cannot control a person's will. Thus, gaining a skill in soccer requires 1. Developing and practicing good habits, 2. Getting input from a good coach, and 3. Constant self-evaluation and desire to improve. Although I have been talking about soccer, these same features exist with other skills. Most of what I have been discussing so far has been the physical motor skills necessary to play soccer. Because soccer is complex, there is a very important intellectual aspect to the game as well. Let me explain. If you have ever watched kindergartners or first graders playing soccer, you will have seen them move around in a great clump of bodies. I call it herd ball. They are trying to just kick the ball toward their opponent's goal. To them, that seems to be the most obvious thing to do, no matter what their coach may be telling them to the contrary. For that age, herd ball works okay since it accomplishes some of the goals of kindergarten soccer. Let the kids have some fun, get some exercise, and of course achieve what all parents secretly desire the most, to get them thoroughly exhausted so they sleep well. As the kids age, more tactical issues come into play, mostly because the kids now have the necessary fundamentals to actually control the ball and pass successfully. Nevertheless, young or inexperienced players are still tempted to make poor decisions on the field. They will either try to make some spectacular pass way forward to a player downfield, or try to dribble the ball through a couple of defenders toward the goal. These seem like obvious approaches. Spectacular pass will get a teammate close to scoring position. Dribbling around defenders gets closer to the goal and leaves the other team in a weaker defensive position. However, it turns out that against a team with smart and talented defenders, these techniques nearly always end up turning over the ball. So it ends up being much better to look around and make a quick pass to an open player. The short, quick pass approach seems counterintuitive. Such a pass may or may not move the ball downfield. In some cases, it may even move the ball backwards. Such a pass is rather dull and unspectacular and does not show what a good player I am. Nevertheless, following the strategy of making easy passes to an open teammate is in the long run a much better way of scoring goals. This skill of making good decisions on the field is a skill just like motor skills of ball control. A player must be able to take into account a broad range of information and judge what is the best move. A player with a poor understanding of successful strategy tactics and the current layout of the players on the field will not make good judgments. The intellectual side of the game, like ball control skills, can be learned through practice and training. It must become ingrained in the thinking of the player through long exposure. Head knowledge is insufficient since no one has time to pause and recollect diagrams the coach drew before the game. Proper training by a knowledgeable coach is required as well. Even the professional players improve substantially under the leadership of a great coach. Finally, players need to self-correct their mistakes. Consider the player who always tries to dribble around defenders. If the player does not recognize, or worse, is unwilling to recognize the deficiency of this move, he will not improve. What I want to highlight here is that soccer is a skill which has both motor and a mental component, but both have the same features of mastery training and self-evaluation. Since we are speaking of the intellectual aspect of skills, I would like to give some more examples of purely intellectual skills. This will help us to see more clearly the way in which wisdom is a skill. The first example I am going to use is the skill of speaking. I am not referring here to public oratory or some other specialized professional speech, but to the act of talking that we all learn as toddlers. I have watched all three of my children learn to talk. I myself learned to talk as a child. However, the process of learning language is, at least to me, a bit mysterious. I don't recall giving them much instruction, but they still picked it up. We did not have our toddlers attend Baby Language Acquisition 101 at the local daycare. There was no formal training at all. It was all informal, organic part of growing up. Kids just start speaking. How do they acquire language? I would like to suggest to you that learning language is a skill that is acquired in much the same way as other skills are acquired through practice, coaching, and self-correction. Babies and children certainly get lots of practice. They want to communicate and are constantly trying to figure out how to do that. As they continue to practice, they improve. As they improve, their words are internalized. They become ingrained. They are no longer sounds used by others that need to be mastered. They become tools through which they communicate and think. Speech is so much a part of them, so ingrained, that they are unconscious of their use of it. They have achieved mastery. They also have live-in coaches who are able to properly train the child. Usually the training is just the right kind for skill acquisition. It is corrective, but there are no memory cards or quizzes. Parents are modeling the proper use of words and the proper pronunciation. If a child makes a mistake, typically a parent will say back the correct word. Eventually, it sinks in. I believed that long, skinny noodles were called paschetti for many years until my siblings got on my case. But parents are not the only ones correcting. The child self-corrects. Most babies say mick instead of milk. I have yet to hear an adult call it that. It is a subtle, long process. Without that self-evaluation, they would never improve. Speaking, then, is a skill acquired in the same manner as other skills. Another example of an intellectual skill is careful interpretive reading. At Gutenberg, students take 3 years of a course we call microexegesis. In that course, we read through various challenging texts, paragraph by paragraph, attempting to understand the meaning of the author. We, as a faculty, do not give lectures or explain techniques of how to interpret texts that we read, mostly because it is not clear what we would say or if it would help. We certainly have ideas about interpretation. Cop-out alert. See the book, Language of God. But the skill of microexegesis is best learned by letting the students stumble through, raising questions and problems that need to be addressed. Despite our rather unstructured pedagogy, every year, students slowly improve their reading and interpretive skills. By the time they have graduated, it is clear that each of the students has made a great deal of progress. I have, on occasion, decided that what the students need is some structured guidance. So I will get on my soapbox and talk about defining words from context or some such thing. Other times, I have thought that they need an example of how I might go about fitting the clues together to make sense of a difficult passage. I think these things sometimes help. Honestly, I am never sure if they help. I think the reason why is that interpretation is a skill, and skills cannot be memorized. There is no body of facts that needs to be learned. Instead, the skill needs to be fostered and nurtured. The student must do the work of making the skill ingrained, making it an intellectual tool which can be called forth effortlessly. Before I move on to talk about wisdom specifically, I would like to mention one very important feature about skills that has been implied but not made explicit. It is not about how skills are gained, but about the way in which we know skills. Skills cannot be articulated. They are known tacitly. Allow me to elaborate. By articulated knowledge, I mean knowledge that I can explain and describe to another person, or that I can write down in a book. I am making an attempt to articulate my ideas about skills right now. Tacit or ingrained knowledge is knowledge that I cannot explain or describe, but it directs our actions and thoughts. A nice example of the difference between the two is the knowledge that we have about directions to our house. Most of us have both articulated knowledge and tacit knowledge of how to get to our house. You have articulated knowledge if you can give directions to a friend. Go down such and such a street and turn right, so on. However, when you go home, you probably do not replay those directions in your head. You just know where to turn. There are lots of little tiny hints that you use, a bush here, a store there, a sense that you have driven the right distance. Lots of times, kids will have a tacit knowledge of directions home, but not articulated knowledge. They have never been asked to articulate their tacit knowledge. They know how to get home, but would be hard-pressed to explain to someone else how they do it. A soccer player who has listened to the coach and watched him draw diagrams on the board may have obtained articulable knowledge. If asked to repeat back to the coach certain principles or plays, he will be able to do so. However, often the knowledge does not make its way onto the field. In the stress of the moment, in the heat of play, the lessons go out the window. The player relies on instinct rather than on the coach's lessons. It is only through a lengthy process of practice and inward adoption that the lessons become part of his instinct, which is tacitly known. When the instinct agrees with the coach's lessons, then the player really knows and understands what he is supposed to understand. Skills are all tacitly known. I cannot give you information that will enable you to handwrite or control a soccer ball. I cannot describe to you how to choose the right words when you speak. I just know these things. They are tacit knowledge. This is a key feature to understanding why skills are not communicable by means of efficient transfer of knowledge paradigm. Transfer of knowledge is only possible with articulable knowledge. How could a teacher possibly tell a student something that the teacher cannot articulate? It is simply not possible. Thus, with skills, they have to be developed in a different way. But, you may say, skills can be dissected and broken down into constituent parts that can be described. We can make a manual on handwriting. Yes, these things are possible. But the knowledge that results from these explanations is knowledge about the skill, not the skill itself. If you told a child that the capital letter A looks thus and so with a picture and an elaborate description, could the child produce the perfect A? No, the child must train his hand. Recall my discussion about the microexegesis classes at Gutenberg about careful interpretation. The skill of reading and interpreting is tacit knowledge. No lecture can possibly take the place of actually doing microexegesis because it is not articulable. A lecture can be part of the training from a coach, but the content of such a lecture is not the skill itself. I have now laid out what I see to be the features common to all skills, so it is time to turn the discussion to wisdom. If, as I have suggested, wisdom is understanding and living in accordance with the truth, how is that a skill? Consider first wisdom as understanding the truth. An understanding of the truth about God, about ourselves, and about the world around us is not something we can pick up in a textbook. How many children have been raised in Christian homes and gone to Sunday school or catechism only to later reject the faith? How many people may be able to give academically satisfactory answers to various moral, personal, or theological questions, but do not make those ideas part of their deepest beliefs and instincts? I heard a perfect example of this distinction on the radio the other day. The radio show was talking about a federally funded marriage counseling program for couples with lower socioeconomic status. The goals of the program were to give these couples some information and guidelines that would help them to interact better with each other and as a family. The feeling was that if marriages could be improved, society in general would greatly benefit, a worthy goal indeed. This program has apparently been going on for many years, costing hundreds of millions of dollars. What was interesting was that according to the program's own goals and methods of assessment, couples who had participated in the program had shown no improvement over those who had not. And in some cases, they were worse off rather than better. Why is that? Now, I do not know any of the details or the methods or the people involved or even how they assess their program. So I am speaking as a total outsider to the program. But I would guess that the reason is because the program only passed on articulable knowledge. What is needed in a marriage is not lessons and maxims to which we may or may not give intellectual assent, but the ingrained tacit knowledge, wisdom. And this type of knowledge is a skill to be gained and not information to be disseminated. The point is that the understanding that is necessary for wisdom is the tacit knowledge that becomes ingrained in us. It is the sort of understanding that we do not have to think about or ponder in our day-to-day lives. It is the sort of understanding that we have a hard time imagining not having. I am sure all of us have had the experience of hearing about some belief or behavior that we simply can't imagine having or doing. Not that we are somehow superior or could not have developed such a belief. Instead, we have developed a different understanding which informs all of our thinking and action. The point is, whether we are wise or not is based on an understanding that is deeply ingrained in our psyche. As an aside here, I am not suggesting that somehow articulated knowledge to which we assent or dissent is not important. Far from it. It is vitally important for us to develop this sort of knowledge. It makes up the universe of ideas that inform our beliefs. It is through an examination of our articulated knowledge that we can critique our ingrained and tacit beliefs. Most of our ingrained beliefs and responses originally came from ideas that were articulated in one form or another by someone else. Bringing them to the forefront of our minds helps to weigh and judge them. The next step in our process is to consider how wisdom is acquired. I think it must be gained much like any skill, mastering that understanding through practice under the tutelage of a coach or coaches with a healthy dose of self-evaluation until it becomes ingrained in us. In the case of wisdom, the type of practice that is needed is not like the practice of soccer or handwriting, where a student focuses on a skill for a particular set amount of time. It is more like the way a baby learns language. It is part of the routine of our life and something that we spend our entire lives practicing and honing, but especially during our youth. As an example of the type of practice I am talking about, let us look at how children might learn honesty and obedience. Children are constantly looking at the world around them to understand it and their place in it. They come to form beliefs about things like honesty and obedience, and they act on those beliefs. They are looking at the results of their actions to see if those results line up with their beliefs. Children who decide that dishonesty is a good policy because it easily achieves the desired goal may be testing to see if their belief about the world is correct. The same occurs when they disobey parents. If they are punished for the dishonesty or disobedience by a good coach, a parent, or a teacher, then they will factor that into their understanding of the world. If the children are not punished, their understanding of the world is impacted in the opposite way. This activity is a sort of practice of living under the eye of a coach. Another example relates to a young adult trying to come to an understanding of the truth about sinful human nature. Consider a young man who has been instructed and nurtured to seek goodness and kindness. As he matures, to become self-conscious of the fact that he is not always kind and good. His actions are not in keeping with his understanding of what he believes about himself. He begins the process of self-evaluation. These realizations are brought to bear on his beliefs about what people in general are like. His beliefs are most likely going to come from the culture around him. Some voices will say that it is instinctual to be selfish on occasion, and that is okay. Some voices may say that humans are naturally good, and so his experience is an aberration. They say that he can become sinless if he has gained victory through God. Some voices will say that his selfishness is an integral part of him, and it is his task in life to recognize and fight it. There will be differing perspectives, some explicit and others implied. He may choose one doctrine over another, or he may simply imbibe the culturally popular outlook. But how that plays out in his life will depend on whether that doctrine or outlook becomes ingrained. He will continue to have experiences and receive teaching about his nature. If he is fortunate, he will have good coaches and teachers to guide him toward what is true instead of what is false. If he begins to take on beliefs which are wide of the mark, then those beliefs will be hard to reverse, much like poor technique on a soccer field. Perhaps the most important of all, he needs to constantly self-evaluate. If he comes to a conclusion and dogmatizes it, he has little chance of making improvements in his understanding. To self-evaluate, he needs to develop other important skills to allow his evaluation to be accurate and just. He needs to be able to weigh the information he receives from his teachers and from his culture. He needs to begin to build a coherent view of himself that explains not only his own experience, but the experiences of others, whether those others are from his present or from the past. He needs to develop critical thinking skills to compare differing claims to each other and compare them to experience. In short, he needs to develop the tools of learning. To the extent that he understands in his heart what is true about himself, he will gain wisdom. As he lives and grows, God, the best of all coaches, continues to show him his shortcomings and failings, and he will become even more wise. Hopefully, you can see how this example can be applied to other aspects of understanding the truth about the world around us. We learn to understand how God looks at us and what he values. We gain an understanding of compassion and mercy. We understand better what drives other people in their choices and what satisfies us. This is the wisdom that the Bible is referring to. But the same is true about more mundane wisdom, wisdom about the truth of nature and society. We can gain an understanding of plants and animals, as well as the media or bureaucracy. We can take classes and read books about these things, but a more personal understanding must come from interaction with these things over time. The more we understand them, the more they become ingrained in our thinking, the more they are part of our everyday responses to life, the wiser we become. This sort of understanding is not something that can be taught in a book. It is a skill. I want to cycle back now to my definition of wisdom, understanding, and living in accordance with the truth. I have so far focused on the understanding part, not the living part of wisdom. So let me address the second aspect. I have made the distinction between understanding and action because it is not at all clear that living in accordance with truth is a direct consequence of understanding. The connection between understanding and action can be tenuous. In my own experience, I do things that I understand to be wrong. I think this experience is ubiquitous. I think this relationship between belief and action is a very complicated one. And I'm certainly out of my depth on this issue. So in keeping with my theme of copying out, I will not address it in any detail. But I can make a couple of observations for this talk. First, how one lives is the ultimate indication of whether one is wise or not. We would not say that a person who had good articulable understanding of something but did not act on that understanding was wise. This is why action cannot be left out of what we think about wisdom. Second, despite the fact that one can act contrary to one's understanding, there is clearly a strong correspondence between action and what I have been calling tacit ingrained knowledge. So much is this the case that I think that everything that I have said about the skill of coming to understand the truth applies equally well to acting in accordance with the truth. The connection between action and tacit knowledge is clear with other skills that we learn. For example, with soccer. Learning ball control is something that becomes so ingrained that I do not have to think about what I am doing. In fact, it would be sort of strange to play without using the skill. Sure, I make mistakes all the time. My skills are not what I would like. I can't just turn off the skills that I do have. I suppose if I really wanted to, I could concentrate on being uncoordinated, but I would have to make an effort at it. The point is that with soccer, and in fact any skill, the ingrained understanding and the activity which results are two sides of the same coin. I am more or less done, but I would like to make one last comment before I summarize. I would like to briefly mention obstacles to gaining wisdom. Clearly, everyone's path to wisdom will be different. For some, the process is more difficult and painful. Some have had horrific coaches that have taught them terrible habits. Some may have been injured either intellectually or emotionally, thus putting another stumbling block in their path. Some have, in my opinion, more or less talent in the development of wisdom, just as there are some who are more or less athletically or intellectually talented. Most often, these obstacles are not from our own choice. They are foisted upon us. Coming to grips with them may even play a role in our development of wisdom. I mention this because I do not wish to downplay the difficulty of the task. But it is a worthy task, one to which we are called, and in the end we must trust God that God is merciful and loving and will grant us the wisdom we desire. I hope these examples have been helpful in explaining how I am thinking of wisdom as a skill. The key points that these examples are designed to highlight are as follows. 1, mastery. Skills are developed through a lot of practice or experiences. The more practice, the better the skill. 2, training. Skills are best learned under the eye of an expert coach or tutor. Such a person gently corrects and guides because skills are not the result of efficient transfer of knowledge. 3, self-evaluation and desire. Skills require constant self-evaluation and self-correction. The one learning the skill must desire to improve and must be willing to admit errors. 4, tacit knowledge. The skill becomes ingrained in such a way that it guides our thoughts and actions without our really being aware of it. It becomes a part of our tool set in facing the challenges of life. 5, finally, wisdom, which I have described as understanding and living in accordance with the truth, is a skill. The wisdom of God is constituted in an understanding of who he is and who we are as his creatures. Mundane wisdom is the understanding of the truths about the mundane world. In both cases, wisdom must be fostered and developed. It is something that we can improve on our whole lives. It is a worthy goal of education. And that is all I have to say. So I can take questions now. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you. In thinking about the process of what you just described, it seems very similar to the grammar, you know, the trivium, ultimately. And there's the big debate about using the trivium for, in 1 year, do you go through all three stages of the trivium in a given subject? Or do you use that, do you just do grammar for a year, which is basically what you're saying is the number one step? And you see a tie between all of that. So the big question for me is that do we engage our young children, ask them to isolate? Obviously the answer is no, we don't want to isolate too much. But do you isolate this idea of having them get the basic training, you know, all that discipline training, and then ask them to also go out there and apply it at the same time? I mean, it seems very gray to me, obviously, to just isolate them all. Like in soccer, you'd go to practice and you have a game that week. You have a game that week, and you constantly engage in the game, and you constantly are asking for the soccer players to apply their skills. But in the handwriting example, pretty soon they just don't use that basic training anymore. And the very basic training, now their basic training is a different level of training, you know. And it rolls through. How would you group that together for students? And so individually, I can go gray all day long. You know, our kids can just be dealt with individually. But what do we do when we're talking about a whole group? So it's not a very articulate question. But I'm just trying to think about the idea of the specific thing that I'm talking about is with our school, we are trying to do basic knowledge for these certain years. We're trying to engage them in dialogue during these certain years. We're trying to engage them in, you know, application of all of that and their own opinions in these certain years, but you're always pulled to trying to make sure they combine them. Mm-hmm. So how do you decide that it's okay for a kid to sit in the training stages and not, you know, get to go on? You're not screwing them up too bad, are you? But
well, with complex skills, lifelong skills, I think that there is definitely, as you're pointing out, sort of an age appropriateness for development of children. And I think it's important to not try and get students to do things that are not age appropriate for them. There is no point in reading difficult texts with third graders or something like that. They just can't do it. They're not ready for it. I don't know exactly how to address the situation in a group where you have a large group and all of them are progressing at different stages. It seems to me like ideally whoever is in charge of teaching or guiding or apprenticing or tutoring or whatever is going as much as possible provide an environment that is appropriate for that student's position or wherever they're at in their process of learning these sorts of skills. And that isn't always possible, obviously, if you have a large class and a number of students or something like that. So I don't have any good suggestions in terms of specific guidelines there, but I don't know if I'm answering your question either. So,
going back to your soccer example,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about bunch ball when they're in kindergarten, but then you've got the Olympics, and all of them have a grammar, all of them have some extra learning and training they need to do with a coach, all of them need extra coaching, and all of them need to present. What was the third step? I'm blanking all of a sudden. Training and coaching.
Oh, self-evaluation.
All of them are going to be doing all of those three things. You know, the kindergartners will do the same thing as the Olympians, and they're just doing it, you know, constantly going up the thermometer, so to speak. And
I see. I think maybe is this getting at your question? The three features that I talk about with regard to skills, those are always concurrent, and no matter where they're not separated. No, I don't think they're separated. I think they're concurrent in all skill development at all times. You always have practice. It's always good to have training, and it's always good to self-evaluate, even at the youngest ages and at the oldest ages. Your pros have to practice soccer. Somebody with advanced intellectual skill in some particular area still has to continue to practice. I think Brandon even said earlier today, I mean, that's a perfect example of a skill. He has to continue to practice every day, otherwise his skills sort of deteriorate a little bit. So I think all three of those features are constantly, they're not They're not this stage at this age and this stage at this age or something. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the spiral diagram, of course. You know, that's what you're describing, obviously, is that spiral.
Yeah, you're constantly improving your skill all along in accordance with where you're at and where you need to be headed, yeah.
Can you talk some more on the stage of self-evaluation and particularly desire and how to foster desire in a student or child who doesn't seem to naturally come by that?
Boy, I sure wish I had an answer to that question.
Well, maybe just in the context of soccer as an example, just helping to think through it.
Sure. I think ultimately the kids who are playing soccer, they're either going to sort of decide that they want to play soccer or they're going to decide that they don't want to play soccer. I can, as say a parent or a coach or something, try and make it fun. I can try and make it interesting. I can try and motivate them with various kinds of carrots and sticks. I can try and model, wow, this is really great, guys. I'm having so much fun. I can tell them that, you know, when you're an adult, you can really enjoy yourself if you can. It's great for your health, those sorts of things like that. You can provide arguments for why it might be a desirable thing to do. If the child does not like soccer, there's just not a whole lot that can be done. I mean, try as you might, they are an individual, and they are going to make a decision for themselves. And if they don't want to play, they don't want to play. And the same thing, I think, is true, unfortunately, about gaining wisdom. If somebody just refuses, does not want to be wise, refuses to evaluate themselves, refuses to think about themselves, refuses to desire to want to become wise and understand the truth, then all you can do is try and motivate them by providing incentives, explaining why this would be valuable to them, helping them to figure, or maybe even helping them to understand the reasons why they don't think wisdom is valuable are not very good reasons. But in the end, if the person does not want to be wise, there's just not much that can be done about it. I don't know, maybe that's kind of a pessimistic answer, but I think that's true about us.
I guess this is somewhat in relation to her question. So, you know, I have several daughters. They all play the piano, and one in particular is very excited, self-motivated, basically self-taught. Another one is not very excited, but I'm requiring all of them to learn the skill just the same. And so I'm just wondering what you mean by no one can be forced in a skill. They must take it on themselves. I think, obviously, I can't force my child to have a good attitude about the skill, but she can still learn to play the piano just the same and just as well. So I don't know if I'm missing your point on maybe childhood versus, you know, reaching a point of adulthood or, you know, somewhat maturity where they're identifying and coming into their own, or...
Sure, sure.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that children, especially our own children, are in a situation where they are very unwilling to defy a parent. And so you have a lot of influence over them, a lot of incentivizing that you can give them. I think that it is possible for your daughter, it would be possible for your daughter if she just decided that she wasn't going to do it. There's nothing that you could do. That's not to say that it isn't appropriate to provide young children, especially, with really, really strong incentives to where it looks like the choice that they have is a really crummy choice, right? Okay, I could go and practice piano, or I could sit in my room in a timeout for the next 3 hours, or I don't know, whatever incentives that you have for encouraging your children to actually do what you ask them to do. So, and I think, with regard to children, I mean, I'm no expert. I mean, I've had kids and stuff, but it seems to me like with children, it's very appropriate to give them very, very strong incentives, both carrots and sticks, to get them to do what we want them to do. They are young. They are not in a position to know what's good for them and what's not good for them. And it is part of our job as parents to sort of help them to understand or to teach them to do the things, even whether they want to do them or not. And at that young age, they are very, very persuadable so that they will do the things that we ask them to do, more or less. And so, but ultimately, if they, even a young child, some of them will just say no. I mean, I definitely had a situation where I was teaching piano to one of my children was taking piano. He was much older at this point. He just stopped practicing. He went through the motions, but I don't know. Did I answer your question or not?
You did. Can I just ask one more quick thing that relates? So I guess we were commenting back here that, you know, possibly it relates to, say, the workplace as they get older and being in a job they're not excited about, but they still have the responsibility to go to work every day and to provide for their family or whatever that situation might be as an adult. And I guess I see that there's value in requiring my child, even if it's not their preference, because I may have the wisdom, you know, and value a skill that they may need in life. Maybe it's something like character instead of the piano, but they're gaining it through piano. And I guess, I don't know, in my view, and maybe I'm just naive, but I require my children. I'm not even encouraging it. It's just something that we do. And we have good days and bad days. And I may reach a point as they get older, you know, we're just entering the teen years, so I have a lot of learning to do myself. But I do see it as something that they don't have full wisdom in the purposes, and they may not have their heart into it, but they can still learn the skill. And hopefully the Lord would use that someday to show them the wisdom behind it.
I mean, I agree. I agree with everything that you said.
They would gain the ability to play. I mean, I guess... Yeah,
I don't think that we're actually disagreeing.
Okay.
I think we're saying more or less the same thing. I think that it is totally and completely appropriate to have our children do things, to learn things, to pick up skills, to learn the discipline of playing piano, for instance, those sorts of things like that. And I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I the only thing I'm saying, and I still don't think this is a disagreement, is that you are requiring them to practice that. They are agreeing with you. There is some will involved in their agreeing with that requirement that you place before them. You cannot force them to agree with you to do that requirement. What you can do is you can say, if you don't do the requirement that I have given you, then you have some other consequence, which is much worse. Right? That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Do you think that is in man's nature to desire to be wise?
Well, it seems to me man's nature is complicated. I don't know. This is a tough one. Man's nature is complicated. I mean, there's a sense in which part of man's nature is to be the creature that God created him to be, which is to be wise. It is part of man's nature to rebel against God. So... yes and no, in a sense. I mean, I think everybody rebels at some level or another against God, but somehow God brings us to him.
I have two boys that are almost 12 and 14, and when I look at them, I think, I'm homeschooling mom, they want to grow to be wise, so they have a desire for that in them. The question just came up because you answered her question as that a student would choose against being wise, and so that's
right.
I don't see that right now in my boys, so I'm wondering when.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people that the trajectory of their lives is to want wisdom from a very young age and to continue to want wisdom and desire wisdom all through their lives. There are some people that seem to want wisdom early on and are pursuing that path and then decide that they reject that. They do not want to follow God. They don't want to know what's true, and they rebel against him. There are some people that rebel very early on and then eventually come to be persuaded that they do want to become wise and then desire it. So there's all sorts of people. So it's not at all surprising to me that there might be, you have children that are very interested in becoming wise, and that's a blessing.
So just to be clear, if a kid does not like to play soccer, that's evidence of moral depravity, right?
That's a really tough question.
So being that the goal of education is to know, to understand, and to live in accordance with the truth, and being that wisdom is a skill that comes from knowledge, which becomes tacit through immersion, if it's through immersion in the way that babies gain language, then I would like to know what you think a life immersed in wisdom, which children can make tacit, looks like. Of what does it consist?
Well, I don't think it's anything different than what we all struggle with as parents and teachers in trying to raise our children up well, or what we as friends and colleagues or acquaintances do in trying to help other people who are around us to make wise choices and things of that sort. So all those things that you have thought about and have attempted in order to foster goodness in your child, to foster discipline in your child, to foster love and concern and compassion and mercy and all those sorts of things, all those things, it seems to me, are things that you would be doing to help that child or that person to learn the practice of living wisely. I don't know if that's addressing your question or not.
Yeah, it is. I think it's within myself to wish that it was more concrete than that, because there's a stumbling block to wisdom, which is bad coaches. I don't want to be one. So I just was curious if you had any more kind of thoughts other than kind of try to follow God and do the best you can.
Well, I think, you know, that's sort of the million-dollar question. If I were truly, truly wise, maybe I could answer that question.
Well, that makes me feel better about myself anyway.
Having been through the mill of parenting, at least, for a while, I learned that once you get to where you've developed some skill, then your kids are gone. But that we, as parents, are also developing skill as we're trying to motivate our children to do so. And this art of motivating our children is just that. It is an art. And a major piece of that art is learning to listen. And the older we get, I think the more we need to concentrate on listening with the ears of a child to understand what our children are motivated by, because they do have motivations. And sometimes we can take those their natural motivations that they have and line them up with the activities we want them to develop skills in, and to see that their natural desire for justice, which is very developed in some children, may motivate them to ride a bicycle. As disparate as those two things sound, there are times when that happens. And God, in his infinite wisdom, has engineered for us oftentimes circumstances and stories in our lives where we learn how an activity and a skill that we develop gets us further down the line toward the things that we are naturally motivated toward. And I think in copying God, we can engineer those things for our children and for our students. It's interesting, though, that much of the question and answer has revolved, it sounds, as much about parenting as it is about the teacher-student relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think this model of education that you're promoting is more akin to a parent-teacher or parent-child relationship than what you're calling the traditional model that is in use in the schools. Just
Exactly. I mean, I'll make a couple of brief comments about that. I think the development of wisdom as a skill is something that happens all your whole life long. And it seems to me that the parent-child relationship is a more focused place to learn that. But I would also add that I was taught a lot about the truth of who I am and who God is and things like that in the process of parenting my own children. And that was a really important aspect of
my own understanding and learning and that sort of thing like that. So we can all aspire to continue to develop that skill of wisdom, it seems to me. And parenting is a particularly good way, a particularly important way in which that happens for us as adults.
Hi. I have two questions. One, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on your definition of mastery and exactly what you mean by that. I think there's a couple different things floating around here. One is people thinking about skills and concrete things that go along with what your examples were, and people talking in general terms about becoming a wise person. And I'm wondering how you correlate your term of mastery with both of those. And then I'm also wondering if you would argue that true mastery of anything, whether it be a concrete skill or wisdom as a person, is only accomplishable through relationship, if that's absolutely integral in your mind.
Well, with regard to the first one, with regard to mastery, I guess I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word for this particular thing that I'm thinking of. Now that I think of it, maybe there are better words that I could have used. But what I'm primarily thinking about is the process by which we take a skill and it becomes part of us and it becomes a tool that we can use, as opposed to something that we have to focus on learning. So, and the reason why mastery might not be the best word is because, for instance, say with regard to learning some musical instrument, you know, there are all kinds of different levels where your muscle memory or whatever has become attuned to where you don't have to think about what it is that you're doing, but you can still improve in that. So if you mastered it, well, all I'm meaning is that it's become something that has become ingrained as part of who you are and how you act and how you think and how your muscles move and all that sort of thing. So you don't have to think about it. It's just part of you. It's part of the way you think. It's part of the way you act. It's part of the way you do things. That's all I'm meaning by that word, mastery. Not like there's some level, and if you get to this level, you're a master. That's not what I'm talking about. With regard to the issue of relationship, well, it seems to me like to the extent that skill is sort of an apprenticeship type of learning process, that it's best to be done in the context of having a tutor or a coach or somebody else who is teaching you, then obviously there's a relationship that's going on in that situation. I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about. I also think that there are so many parts of learning about who we are and who God is that can only be learned in our interaction with others, that without relationships with other people, it would be almost impossible to learn those sorts of things, to gain the insight, to gain the experience, to practice the living. So that in that sense, yeah, relationships are necessary. Is that addressing the question that you're asking?
Yes, it's addressing it. I guess I'm sort of taking, I'm a parent too and a teacher, and I'm thinking of myself as a mentor, but I'm also thinking of myself as a learner.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the question behind my question was, if I wanted to master something, and it sounds like you kind of backpedaled a little bit on your definition of mastery, but if I wanted to be able to master something, I was wondering if your argument would be that I would need to go and put myself in relationship with someone, or if, in your opinion, it would not be possible for me to master or reach a level that is consistent with the idea of mastery without doing that. I'm kind of thinking of like autodidacts and people who can learn in different ways, and just mm-hmm. kind of wondering mm-hmm. how integral you think it is.
Well, it seems like there are lots of different avenues by which we can understand the truth of the world around us. Part of that is going to be thinking about myself, sort of a self-evaluation, maybe on my own, you know, considering who I am. Part of that might be studying and reading books. It seems like that's an appropriate place to be learning that. But the practice of it, it seems like you're saying, is mostly going to be in interacting with others. That's where the experience comes in. That's where the practice comes in, of actually interacting with others. So, Yeah, it seems like you have to have interactions with others in order to really develop. I'm not sure about that. I don't know. Maybe somebody else has some comments or thoughts on that. Maybe there's some other things that could be somebody back here.
My thought is, what do you think about this? What if it seems like performative arts, and I don't just mean music or acting or skateboarding, but things that demand some sort of performance, it seems to me like those almost always require some sort of apprenticeship to a master, whereas mastery over a body of knowledge might not, because you're thinking of autodidacts, and I can think of autodidacts who could maybe master a computer language, which is a bit of a performative art, but it seems to be like apprenticing to a master when the end goal is a performance of some sort, a task of some sort. It seems like an apprentice-master relationship seems to me necessary. I'm having a hard time thinking of an exception, whereas just knowledge of just gripping knowledge, just coming to a body of knowledge might not require that.
I think that's true, and I don't think coming to a body of knowledge is necessarily developing a skill. It's just you could be using skills in developing a body of knowledge, but having just knowing stuff and having it in your head and having information ahead of you is not necessarily what I'm referring to as a skill. It's making that a part of you and acting on it in a personal way so that it becomes deeply ingrained in you and you act on it, that sort of thing. That kind of knowledge is gained in the same way as a skill is.
Yeah.
And I agree completely with regard to musicians and acting and performance kinds of things. Even a computer programmer, there's a skill at being able to program well. And the best way to learn that is by sitting next to a guy who's really good at programming and asking him questions left and right. Or at least that's what I did.
It occurs to me that there are possibly even more, but at least two ways that we could use the word mastery.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like even in your points, you have kind of two, and that there's mastery and that we're seeking to be as well-versed in whatever skill we're pursuing as possible, and in that way we are seeking mastery. But then we're also seeking mastery in the sense that we are seeking to reach the level that, well, either reach the level of our coach or reach the level to which our coach is asking us to aspire. And in that sense, pursuit of a skill has tiers of mastery, as either your coach gives you new goals or you to the point where you're equal with your coach and you seek for some new coach or inspiration or, you know, whatever it is. So it seems like there are two ways in which it could be thought about.
Yeah.
And one is a goal that can never be reached, and the other one is incremental steps towards becoming more and more proficient in the art that you're pursuing.
Yeah, I probably should not have used, now that I'm thinking about it and seeing the way people think of the word mastery, that was a poor choice of words. Maybe ingrained might be better, or embedded, or becoming a part of myself, or tacit, or something like that. That's really what I'm getting at on that particular issue. Practice in such a point that it becomes a part of me so that I don't have to think about it. I don't have to focus on it. Mastery, I think, probably was maybe not the right
word. Yeah, but I mean, it seems like, but even in that sense, at least when we're talking about wisdom or living life well, in a sense, we're never going to get there in this, at least in my perspective. I don't think we're ever going to get there. That's what we want. That's what we're seeking for. But
sure.
we will get better at it in mm-hmm. some sense. So, mm-hmm.
I think I disagree with you. I think mastery is a really good word to use.
Okay.
Two options come to mind. I think the corollary might be second nature, to use the Aristotelian term.
Yeah, second nature.
We have the nature we're born with, but if we master a skill, it becomes part of who we are. It's our second nature.
Yeah,
but when
good.
You think of apprenticeship, as I understand apprenticeship, you know, you have the journeyman stage and so on, and you become a master not when you have exhausted the possibilities of that art, but you've become a master when you know the elements of the art, you know how to use the tools of the art, to such a degree that you can assess yourself objectively.
Mm-hmm.
You can know whether you successfully performed the task you were trying to perform. And because of that, you also can turn around and teach somebody else and assess what they're doing. And I think that's a form of mastery that's very practical, especially in light of wisdom. And it seems to me it's very useful. So I wouldn't give up the word too quickly.
Yeah. Like I said, mastery was the perfect word choice in this particular situation. All right. That's all.